You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
And now, for our more dreadful sacrifice.
Boy, all we gotta do is build an act, make you star. Dumbo the Great!
You're OG, and I feel fine.
There, you slime-eating dogs, you scum-sucking pigs,
you sons of a motherless goat.
I am big. It's the picture that got small.
I've never been alone with a man before, even with my dress on. With my dress off, it's most unusual.
What is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hey, what about Major Kong?
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. As ever, many thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last couple of hours, but now it's time for Bums on Seats, the show that doesn't need distracted accountants and a befuddled Warren Beatty to tell you what the best pictures are. I've ruined the intro already, never mind. My name is Mark Liversidge, and joining me today on the Bums on Seats sofa are reviewers Ashley Capaldi.
Hello.
Laura Poole.
Hiya.
Eleanor Franks.
Hello.
And Alistair Ryder.
Hey there.
And that was all in order around the studio, which is going to make it much easier for me to remember who's who. Today's show is a variation of scale and pacing from the normal cinematic treadmill. Michelle Williams, Kristen Stewart and Laura Dern are the heart and soul of Kelly Reichardt's intimate Certain Women. A superhero finally senses his mortality in Logan, a downscaled western-themed finale to the adventures of Hugh Jackman's Wolverine. The phenomenally named young actress Royalty Hightower plays the young dancer at the heart of stylish drama The Fitz. Isabella Pear is a rape victim with a strange passive ambivalence to the crime in Paul Verhoeven's controversial L. And we have a podcast special with a look at the gorgeously stylized feminist horror The Love Witch. Plus, we talk to local filmmaker John Holdsworth about his movie Any Major Dude, a feature film made with local actors and on a budget of very nearly nothing. All that to come, but we start the show in Big Sky Country.
Hey, Flint.
What are you doing here?
Came to see my lawyer.
My wife wants me out of the house.
You can't keep coming here.
Your wife works for you.
No, she's the boss, actually.
I wonder how much more there might be buried here.
I was so afraid I'd get out of law school and be selling shoes. My mom works in a school cafeteria, my sister in a hospital laundry, so selling shoes is the nicest job a girl from my family's supposed to get.
Hey, Will. Good news. Your lawyer's here.
No one understands what my life has become.
I don't mean to keep you from getting to work or anything. I just knew if I didn't start driving, I wasn't going to see you again. I didn't want that.
It'd be so lovely to think that if I were a man, people would listen and say, okay. Oh, it would be so restful.
Our first film of the show takes us to the farming plains of Montana, where writer-director Kelly Reichardt interweaves the lives of four very different women. Based on the short stories of Maile Malloy, Certain Women stars Laura Dern as a lawyer struggling to shake off a persistent client, a man who insists he was duped out of an injury at work settlement. Meanwhile, Reichardt's regular collaborator Michelle Williams plays a woman who realises she is being increasingly cast adrift by the male-dominated conversation around her. And a third story follows quiet farmhand, played by Native American actress Lily Gladstone, whose need for companionship may be answered when she meets a young teacher played by Kristen Stewart. Alistair, Certain Women is an antidote to the usual breakneck pace of Hollywood blockbusters that these actors are best known for. But did its more measured pace work for you?
Yes, because it works very well as a character study. Certainly the first and third stories, I feel that the Michelle Williams story that's the sort of the centre of the sandwich around it is probably the least realised of the three and just seems like an excuse for Reichardt to work with her regular collaborator again. But compared to a lot of Kelly Reichardt's earlier films, which didn't really work as character studies, after working in different genres such as the Western with Meek's Cut Off and the Thriller with Night Moves, she's taken these sort of different approaches to studying characters and then just applied it to the sort of story that she would have made towards the start of the career. And I think it's really paid off. I think this is her strongest film to date.
Is it easy to categorise into any kind of genre? Because as you say, she's done Western and thriller previously. If we were trying to describe this to people interested in it, how would you try and encapsulate it? Or is it even possible to do that?
I mean, I would call it a drama, but it's more of a character study than a drama. Not a lot happens in it if you sort of look past the Laura Dern story, which, as producer Toby was just saying, the moment it feels like it's going to go into incident, it then just takes a left turn and then becomes like more about character details yet again. So, yeah, it's a loose drama, I would say.
Ellen, it's one of those films where very little actually happens. As Alice just alluded to, every time it looks like something might be on the verge of happening. I mean, you tell people it's a film with a hostage situation and they might expect something dramatic, but it's not that at all. Do you think people could be disappointed by that if they're not really sure what they're letting themselves in for?
I think if you're looking for a film where a lot happens and there's a lot of plot, that might not be the film for you, but I really liked it. I didn't want it to end, and I thought it was very interesting that it was based on short stories because it's got a very literary nature about it.
Yeah, it's to me, it sort of feels like actually sitting in a shop window and sort of watching the world go by. I think it's a film for certainly people like me, people who love people watching, where you can actually gaze into the lives of these characters. It's a film where, again, Kelly Reichardt sort of returned, as she did with Mixed Cutoff, to the sort of Midwest as well, these big open spaces. These characters can sometimes feel lost in those kind of situations.
Yeah, interestingly, she also gives you a lot of access to the characters' inner lives without spelling it out, and I think that's another thing that she's very strong on.
Yeah, Laura, if I come to you, the actresses themselves, I mean, the three that are getting the most prominence, of course, on the posters, who are Laura Dern, Kristen Stewart and Michelle Williams, but also Lily Gladstone, who puts in a fantastic performance in the Kristen Stewart strand. It seems that Kelly Reichardt is able to attract more and more well-known names to her films now. What do you think it is about her films that's attracting this kind of calibre of actor?
Well, it does have a different sort of pace to most of the films the actresses are usually in, and the more her following grows, the more they do it. But for me, what I found the most difficult to understand is why Kristen Stewart was billed as one of the three main leads. She's not the main in her part of the story for me. That's Lily Gladstone. And if you look her up on IMDb or some of the other sites, she's just classed as the rancher. She doesn't even get her name put on a lot of the sites. And she stole the show. It was all about her. I can't understand why they'd say Kristen Stewart unless it was just to advertise this massive name that they've got in the film. She's barely in it. And Lily Gladstone all the way won it for me.
Ashley, it's... I think we sort of mentioned that there are three different strands of this. They very loosely overlap. You see Laura Dern wandering through Lily Gladstone's story at one point, but there's no real sense of tying these together. Do they paint a coherent picture of this part of America?
It doesn't really matter where it's set. It's one of those, to say character study again, like these people could live anywhere. It's about them going quietly about their lives. And I think the vast expanses were used to reflect the fact that it's the minutiae of your everyday, that things that are important to you, and they follow hands and feet with the camera a lot, so especially with the rancher. So that's her day, the monotony of it, the very small tasks that make up your whole life. And I think that's probably why she chucked it in the middle of the desert. But this could have been set anywhere because it is the performances that make it, and down to the face work. I think that's why more people are attracted to work with this director, because you get to act a lot in her films. You get to show what you can do. You're not wasting time in sort of choreographed fight scenes or anything. It's down to the way your eyebrows move even. And I liked what Kristen Stewart did with her character. She didn't steal it away from Lily Gladstone. She was the best actress in this whole film, I think. But I really like what she did with her character and sort of the nervous use of her hands, because she's known to be quite a sort of awkward person in general. That didn't really work when they chucked her in a Twilight franchise. She's supposed to be a leading lady, but in this it really worked, and she had sort of very, well, that's a complex relationship, those two anyway, and her half matriarchal care for her, and then the, is there a romantic element, and both of them, Kristen and Liddy, played off each other brilliantly. I loved them the best out of all three storylines.
I think the Kristen Stewart and Liddy Glanskin story is getting the most attention from people who've seen the film, and Kristen Stewart, maybe as an actress, it's fair to say she's been a bit underrated, despite the fact she's been in films like Clouds of Sils Maria. She's got Olivia Sayas' Personal Shopper coming out later this month. You know, she's building a significant body of work here. Do we think it's time to give Kristen Stewart her due? Anyone come in on that? Yeah, Laura?
Yeah, absolutely. I think due to the Twilight franchise, she is always going to be tarred with that brush, so to speak, even though I'm a big fan of that franchise. But since she's made some really clever choices since that ended, where she can properly show her skills, and she's really coming into her own now. People don't so much remember her as Bella the Vampire. She is her own person now, and she is a really good actress. I remember seeing her in, I think it was On the Road with Jared Gutland, or however you say it, and that was when she just finished the films, and you know, you realise, wow, this lady can act. She's not just a tween film person.
There's a lot you can do with an actual good script, isn't there?
There is, but she does, you can feel her personal awkwardness in all her films, I think, but it works
it
for the role she chooses.
Yeah, it works really well.
Let's talk a little bit about Michelle Williams-Strand, because that's the one certainly some of the people I've spoken to have found the most difficult within the film, to see what it's actually adding to the film. It's maybe a little bit in the sense that I think the Laura Dern Strand and the Lily Gladstone Strand, as we'll now call it fairly, are two strands which are maybe a little more downbeat, and actually the Michelle Williams of the three main leads is the most positive. Is that a fair assessment?
I thought the opposite, perhaps, that was one of the more depressing strands. It's kind of left open. She's trying to get this stone from the old man who, and at the end, it's very unsatisfying for her. And she sort of, you're wondering what. I think Michelle Williams actually seems to be quite depressed in that strand.
I mean, it's probably something common to at least the first two strands, where there's a relationship between the male and female characters. So is this purely a female perspective that we're getting from Kelly Reichardt?
It's that strand's the most obviously feminist one. It's making a statement, and that it was the slowest storyline, but the one that I was inwardly screaming at the most. The scene on the sofa, where the guy they're talking to, his body language is faced towards the man in the room. He refuses to give her eye contact. And it just so happens, well, International Women's Day last week, there was a great speech made by one of our female directors at work. And she says, I just let them have that awkward moment when we're introduced to the team, they say, and this is our director, and they'll turn to the guy and go to shake his hand. And he's like, oh, no, this lady next to me is my director. And that, I think we've all gone through something like that in our own lives as women, and that was the bit that I actually latched onto personally the most, even though that was the slowest storyline for me.
It's not to discredit some of the male acting talent as well, particularly Jared Harris in the first sequence as well. There seems to be a sort of sense of frustration and stillness in this. I think back to films like Meek's Cut Off, one of Kelly Reichardt's earlier works, where they were heading out in this Western scenario. Without to give too much away, you never actually really see where they get to. For me, often it feels like it's not about the actual end of that journey as well, it's about the telling, and not all of these stories get a particular sense of closure either.
Yeah, I did see one person criticise the film. I'm not fully on board with this criticism, but they said that each story feels like the first act of a particularly good film, but I felt that that's why it worked. It's not a story, it's just sort of a portrait of these people's lives, and that's why it's more of a character study than a drama. There's no sense of dramatic closure, but it feels insightful, and I believed in each character. I believe that these situations are happening right now. Even the hostage one, as ridiculous as that was, I could believe that that was happening.
And there's lots of little odd moments that are worked in to try and lighten the mood here. Even the number of scenes we see in the Lily Gaston story, she's just going out doing her daily work with the dog, going out and doing various bits and pieces. Do we think those little touches are essential to actually making this a more rounded film, given its slower pacing?
They are little light moments, and the dog's constant barking, that there is a titter in the audience, and but she's reflecting real life. There's a lot of the time you go to work, you spend an inordinate amount of time of your own life at work, and that's what Lily Gladstone's doing. And then you have little peaks of joy here and there, hopefully more often than maybe poor Michelle Williams does, but she's really, really brilliantly mirroring true life. So there's not one set tone throughout the film, just like there isn't every day for us.
I think we have to probably address the point which has been discussed most in the press about this, and that's the slow cinema feel. Kelly Reichardt's films are very deliberately paced. Even Night Moves, which was structured like a thriller, is unhurried and unrushed. Do we think that people need to be aware of that as they approach this as a film? Because it is of a different style. Kelly Reichardt's got a very distinctive storytelling voice, but it is much more measured than a lot of filmmakers.
Well, I mean, character is action. If you're invested in the characters and you believe in the characters, then it doesn't matter what drama's unfolding. You're invested in the characters. Yeah. They're pulling the story forward.
And it's really reminded me of Moonlight a bit, the Lily Gladstone scene, because it is like you're coming up to a really, really tense climactic end. You're just wondering what's going on here, what's she going to say, will they, won't they? And that was action for me. That was the huge crescendo of the film.
I think even in things like the Michelle Williams strand, sometimes just the little tiny glances when she sat talking to René Auberjonois's character, the old man, who incidentally I love because he was in Star Trek Deep Space Nine, so I think I was instantly sold on that strand, but that's geeky me coming out. When they just sat chatting and just those odd little sideways glances you get from Michelle Williams, do we think these kind of performances are performances that actors are looking to give, because they're not the kind of big, dramatic, overblown performances that you normally associate with things like award season? Is it something that maybe will get more of a prominence, you know, now that people like Kelly Reichardt are giving people a chance?
Not when these films don't make enough money. They're not going to make enough films like this. This is the only film from this director to break the million-dollar mark, I think. So it's a shame, but not enough people like the slow pace. They're not going to go see it, so people aren't going to pay to make it.
So, as we're sat here, and I think generally all really having taken a lot from this film, what can we do to convince our listening audience that they should be helping to make sure more films like this get made by going to see it?
It's my second favourite of the entire year, and not from January, including 2016. Only Moonlight, which is an Oscar winner, by the way, comes before this film.
that is as good a recommendation as any. Anyone else, anything they'd really like to call out to sell it to people?
No, I think we'll just put that quote on the poster. Sorry. No.
Everyone is so desperate to voice their support for this film. Alistair, you come in first and then...
Oh, no. Eleanor,
ladies first.
I was going to say, if you like reading novels, maybe, and you also like films, maybe give it a go and try and see this film.
Which I would hope is most people. Right, we're getting a good capture of the audience here, Alistair.
Just give something different a go. It's the sort of film that most people, if they would watch it, they would probably wait till home viewing, but it is a cinematic experience. The Midwest, the Northwest of America just looks beautiful, and I think it deserves to be seen on the big screen, because it is cinematic, and that's what we're not even mentioning. We're focusing on the characters, but it does look beautiful and cinematic.
And Laura, the final word.
Oh, to end it on a bad note, I'm not one who can help you sell this film. I do love reading books.
She liked Logan, though.
I liked Logan, yes, I did. I just felt that enough didn't happen. If you're going to watch this film, in my opinion, if you like more fast-paced action films, watch it at home when you're sick in bed one day.
So we're suggesting, I think, you both watch this film in the cinema and at home, and there can't be much more of a recommendation than that. Certain Women opened last week but still has some screenings at the Arts Picture House. It's a certificate 12A. 2017 at the cinema will see another assault of superheroes. More Spider-Man, more Thor, more Batman, and for the first time in a significant role, some Wonder Woman. But oddly, this year of superheroes starts off with a film that draws one superhero's incarnation to a close. Logan is the ninth adventure for Wolverine, played by Hugh Jackman since the first X-Men movie in 2000, which makes me feel terribly old. Set in the near future, Logan ditches the bright comic book colours for the sandstorm grey of a wasted and tried America. In a world where mutants and heroes are a receding memory, Wolverine lives as quietly as possible. His power of healing is fading at last, and he spends his days looking after an elderly and sick Professor Xavier. Then one day, a stranger arrives looking for help and escape for her and her child.
We got ourselves an X-Men fan. Maybe a quarter of it happened. And not like this. In the real world, people die.
Logan.
I don't want to talk about it.
Logan.
Just stop.
Be careful.
I need the girl. What girl?
Go get her.
No.
No. No.
And we're down.
She's like you. Very much like you.
I am not whatever it is you think I am.
She needs our help.
Someone will come along.
Someone has come along.
Laura, Logan narrows its focus and scale more than any comic book movie in recent memory. Does that change of focus work?
Yeah, it did. It's the Westchester, hope I've said that right this time, incident is mentioned at the beginning of the film, which leads to the fact that there's not many mutants around nowadays. And so it's almost not a mutant film anymore. You could almost forget, other than when Adamantium steel rods come out of his hand, that it's an X-Men original film, really. It worked for me, though. You get to see the character in so much more depth, and he really gets to portray his acting ability and the struggle that Logan faces, which you don't get when it's the large, big Marvel X-Men films where there's about 20 main characters. So it definitely worked for me.
Alistair, is there a risk that these become a sort of actor-driven projects? I think with Hugh Jackman saying it was going to be his last film and I think being heavily involved in the development of the film, does that actually drive a decent story, or is it just servicing the needs of closing off the character?
Well, it's not so much of being an actor-driven prospect that was the main worry. I think the main worry was that after Deadpool was released last year, that they were going to just make R-rated superhero movies, and that all it would be was just more violent, more crude, just more of the same. And actually, the reason that Logan works is because it's just taken a completely different direction. It's darker, but it's dark in a way that actually services the character. And Hugh Jackman does give his finest performance as the character, and you can see it's the one that he's been waiting 17 years to make. And a lot of people have been saying that the tone of the film is very Western, but I would actually say it's more dystopian sci-fi. I mean, it's set next to the American-Mexico border, and there are lots of political parallels between the 2029 that's portrayed in the film and the reality that we're living in now, and it never calls attention to it. It doesn't, like, lecture you, like, yeah, this is what America's like now. It just assumes that you're smart enough to recognise that that's there and tell an incredibly engrossing story around it.
I have to say, I was almost taken out of the film when we actually end up in Las Vegas, and all of a sudden you realise that most of the rest of the world is carrying on as normal, that the mutants have sadly almost come to an end. It's very much a two-hander for a lot of film. You've got Hugh Jackman's Professor Charles Xavier, sorry, Hugh Jackman's Wolverine and Patrick Stewart's Professor Charles Xavier, maybe being explored in more detail than their relationship in any of the previous 6-7 films they've been in together.
Absolutely. In the original X-Men films, obviously, Charles Xavier helps Wolverine, so we see a bit of a relationship. But this is the most focus on themselves, where things such as even Logan helping Xavier go to the bathroom because he's a frail old man now, you far see the relationship more. They have in-depth conversations, and you know that Wolverine isn't one to be touchy-feely and talk about feelings and have bonds, but you can see that he looks up to this man and feels like he's almost a father to him. And it's nice that this film can explore that in a further way than, again, the big X-Men films could possibly do.
And it's a film which calls on certain influences as well. You mentioned the dystopian sci-fi. It has very strong influences on things like Shane, to the point where it hammers the point home by having a 2 or 3 minute clip of Shane actually in the film for people to watch, just in case they didn't get the reference. Mm-hmm. Is this a film heavy-handed in places, or does it manage to sort of keep things moving because it's much smaller scale?
I think it's definitely heavy-handed in calling out the Shane influence, because any sort of cine-literate audiences and film critics would be aware of that comparison. But the fact that it includes Patrick Stewart watching it in a hotel room, commenting on how he used to how he saw that as a child and all about the character. It's just like James Mangold is behind the camera saying, I want my film to be mentioned in the same breath as Shane. And the thing is, the film is strong enough and stands on its own 2 feet enough to actually warrant that comparison in a positive light without the need for that scene. And I just thought it was incredibly unnecessary.
It is a film which is much more small-scale than its inspiration. The Old Man Logan comic book, which Mark Miller helped co-write, features the Hulk and Red Skull and lots of other sort of Marvel staples. And this has taken the decision to move away from that and actually, in terms of the action sequences and what's going on in the background, at times it almost gets left behind. We don't see Richard E. Grant, who's the main antagonist, until about an hour into the film with any regularity. Is there that balance of good and evil that works in the film?
I think there is. I mean, with this film, they've tried to make three of the comic books into one film. So obviously they can't go into full detail on everything, especially as it's commonly known that this is Hugh Jackman's last Logan film. He wanted to go out, to say it with a bang. He didn't want to be old and people thinking this isn't realistic anymore. I don't want to see this again. It's boring. So they had to combine the three, and you can't then just get everything into that. But I think they worked well with how they mixed them. There was obviously that there's things that are different, and from the beginning we're spoken to about his adamantium poisoning supposedly, and that's played throughout the film, and in the comics that's a little bit different. It's suggested he could more have been infected with the virus from his enemies, but that's what they have to do. I just think Dougray Scott must be kicking himself that he had to film Tomb Raider reshoots and missed out on this part.
Maybe there's a parallel universe somewhere where Dougray Scott is now as famous as Hugh Jackman and sang in Les Miserables. One thing I do want to ask you about, because I'm the old fogey in the studio today and everyone else is just a young whippersnapper, a lot of this is looking at mortality, growing old, offset against Daphne Keane's character sort of coming in and then the mentoring relationship they have. How do those issues of age and mortality resonate with people as young as yourselves?
As young as myself. I think it was handled very gracefully, particularly in the Patrick Stewart storyline, because as soon as he's introduced, he's going on this like excessive rant, which includes possibly the strangest Taco Bell product placement I've ever heard in a film, in part of this sort of stream of consciousness rant, and it seems that he's just losing his mind. And when it's like revealed that he has is it Alzheimer's, that it's a form of Alzheimer's, yeah, that he's revealed to have had, it's really hard hitting, because you just, from the previous films, you just assume that superheroes are invincible, and yeah, it's hard hitting, and I've described that very terribly.
No, I don't think so. I think to wrap this one up, because we've got so much more to talk about, is this a film that we recommend to people if they've not seen an X-Men movie before? Does it work on its own terms?
Yes, it does, I think. Even if you haven't seen them before, you can pick up the storyline. You might be wondering why he's got adamantium fused to his skeleton, how he can self-heal, but just go with it. And at the end of the day, this has set us up for a whole new series of X-Men with a whole new lot of characters, and it's just the beginning. It's end of one chapter and it's the beginning of the next, and stick with it.
And so the Hollywood machine keeps rolling. Logan opened last week and is still showing at both Cambridge Multiplex Cinemas. It's a certificate 15, although it's a strong 15, I think we would say, at the very least. So do be aware if you're not used to that kind of film. This coming Monday sees the premiere of a new comedy at the Arts Picture House. The movie, called Any Major Dude, is the passion project of local teacher John Holdsworth, who wrote the script, assembled the volunteer crew, and kept faith in the film's production through the 2 years it took to finish. A comedy of a musical midlife crisis, Any Major Dude cost a minuscule sum of £5,000 to make and was shot in and around the Cambridgeshire villages of Swavesey and Over. Local pubs, shops and neighbours' houses were the film's venues and sets, while the cast was drawn from volunteers and actors from local amateur dramatic groups. The power behind the throne of Bums on Seats and occasional host Toby Miller sat down with John Holdsworth to discuss the ins and outs of making a debut feature film for next to no money. But to start, John talked about where the idea of making a feature film had come from in the first place.
The camera, once inserted, will take a look at your large colon and small bowel.
You don't be lying on your deathbed thinking, oh, I...
Don't mention deathbeds!
I want to play in a band at Freya's party.
I looked at it like putting on a pantomime or a stage play.
because I know people who are involved in the amateur dramatics in Cambridge, and you know, I've been to see things like that. And I thought, well, if they can do it with a play, then surely I'll be. It might even be easier to do it with a film. But the hardest thing is getting people together who are not professionals, or you know, who are doing it in their spare time. If you manage to get a slot for a specific location, then you have 10 people involved in the shoot. You've got to find a date when all 10 people are available. And what typically happens is 8 people will respond to you almost immediately and say, yes, that's fine. The 2 people who don't respond will eventually come back and say, sorry, I can't make that date. And so you're back to square one. So trying to get the bits of the jigsaw with the location, the actors, the sound people, the camera guys, that was the hardest bit. But we got there in the end.
Could you explain a little bit about the genesis of the idea? Were you looking for something that you felt you weren't getting at the cinema?
No, not really. I mean, it was just one of these holiday things where I was thinking about what was going to be the next step for me. And I'd been speaking to Peter Tomlin, who's the assistant producer and script editor on the film, about writing something. And I said to my wife, I'm thinking of writing a screenplay. And my wife, who was very supportive, said, do it, you know. And so consequently, that was the sort of catalyst that set it off. And I think it was just before New Year. So it was almost like a New Year's resolution.
So tell me a little bit about the plot and the characters for Any Major Dude.
Peter and I had been in a band, a dodgy sort of pub band, for a while, and the sort of basic idea came from some of the things that happened to us when we were in this particular band. So we came up with a basic outline of a plot about a guy who wants to form a band with his friends to play a surprise number at his wife's 40th birthday party. And the question is he doing it for her, or is he doing it because her ex-wife used to be a pop star, so he's trying to prove something both to himself and to his wife? And the plot then sprung from that initial idea.
So how did you go about putting together your filmmaking team? You have a director, Sean Baker, you have a co-writer.
Yeah, well, as I say, the co-writer and assistant producer, Peter, I was in a band with, is a friend of mine. He was the drummer. I knew Sean, the director, because he directed pantomimes with my children in, and I also knew he was involved in the Cambridge amateur dramatic scene, boards, combined actors of Cambridge, that sort of thing. I trust Sean. He's good with actors. He can speak to actors in a way that, you know, they speak a different language to me.
Your cast is entirely amateur, and you made this for almost no money.
I made it, I would guess, for the price of a small second-hand car, I would say. All the cast are amateur actors, mainly from boards, combined actors of Cambridge. One of the reasons why I was keen to get Sean Baker, the director, on board is he knows actors. He knew people who would fit the parts very well. I'm very pleased with the way it's been cast. But yeah, nobody has been paid. It's like, again, I'm going to use the analogy, it's like putting on a pantomime.
I think it's starting to bother him that instead of marrying a pop star, I chose a gardening journalist.
Well, you did, didn't you?
Yeah.
I want you guys to be my backing band.
Tell me a little bit about the music for the film. I believe it's an original soundtrack.
I'd identified some songs that commercial songs that I thought would fit in, and I had half a dozen, some of which were based on the names of characters in the original screenplay. But of course, you just can't get the rights to have these particular songs. I mean, it's financially, it just wasn't viable. So again, I thought, well, to hell with it, I'll write the songs. So I wrote the songs, and we managed to perform the songs. And again, it's just one of those fortunate things that it actually turned out better having done the songs ourselves rather than if we'd have used the songs that I had in mind. So, yeah, it worked out well in the end.
He touched his nose and he licked his lips.
pull out his ears and thrust out his ears. He's saying, be my bear. Be my bear.
Has the last 2 years has and the process of making this film changed your perception of how you view any film?
Yeah, because for a long time when nobody would even look at my script, I'd watch sitcoms and films and think, God, mine's better than this. This is terrible. So, but then also I started looking at the way films are cut, the way that edits are done, transitions are done. I'm a lot more... interested in what films the sound is like. In a way, you know, I just used to watch the plot really, but having been involved in on this side, it does change your view on when you're watching a film, things that you look out for, and it does make you a little bit more hypercritical, which is probably not a good thing.
It's a rare thing of film production, because you can have everybody, young and old, working on it together. So I wondered if the production on Any Major Dude, if it became sort of a focal point for the community.
Oh, you certainly used a lot of people. I think actors and crew, I think we used about 60 people. You say about bringing people together, it's strange because it's not like doing a play or a pantomime where everybody meets each other. At the premiere that we've got at the Arts Picture House in Cambridge on Monday the 13th will be the first time that a lot of these people have ever actually met, because they're in scenes, different scenes, or, you know, they weren't involved on particular days. But certainly, I think there is a bit of a buzz about whenever we were filming anything in Swavesey or Over, you know, people would come out and say, oh, you know, what are you doing? And it sort of did create a bit of a buzz.
But it does have a life now that maybe you weren't expecting. Your premiere is at the Arts Picture House, and that's sold out.
Yeah.
You have another screening on the 25th?
On the 20th, on Monday the 20th, which is through the Our Screen initiative. And again, that's on Monday the 20th at 9 p.m. at the Arts Pitch House. I think if you go to ourscreen.com and put look for the film Any Major Dude, that's where you can buy tickets from.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to John Holdsworth for coming into the Cambridge 105 studio for the interview. As mentioned, Any Major Dude premieres this coming Monday at a sold-out screening at the Picture House. But there's another showing scheduled, thanks to the Our Screen initiative, on the 20th of March. Visit the Arts Picture House website for more details, or head straight to the film's website, www.anyotherdude.co.uk.
I'm Mandy Morton.
And I'm Nicola Robson.
And collectively we present
The Eclectic Light Show,
a monthly arts magazine featuring
the very best in
theatre, music, film, books
and celebrity interviews.
Join us on the first Sunday of every month
from 2 till 4
on community radio
in your city,
Cambridge 105.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Meanwhile, here on Bums on Seats, we've still the high drama of Elle, but first we take to the gym, or is it the dance floor? Some of the fantastic music in the film, which we'll maybe get to later. Though slightly overshadowed by the enormous attention on the Oscar-winning Moonlight, fellow new release The Fitz also offers a view of African-American youth that tells a story without reverting to the standard clichés. Written and directed by debutant Anna Rose Holmer, The Fitz is set entirely in the corridors and grounds of an inner-city school come community centre. We're not quite sure which, so we're hedging a bet. 11-year-old Tony, in a wonderful performance from newcomer Royalty Hightower, spends her time outside class shadowing her brother's boxing regime. Looking for more competition, Tony joins the dance class, who are working on new routines for the state championships. But just as she begins to find her feet, the other dancers begin to fall mysteriously ill, as a fainting sickness sweeps the school. Eleanor the Fitz runs to just a compact 72 minutes. Does that give it enough time to offer anything interesting on the struggles of adolescence?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the fact that it is quite short, throughout the film, I felt like it was quite a long, short film. And then the end just completely blew me away. I really like this film. And I've really found it very interesting.
And it's a film which packs a lot into that short running time. We've sort of mentioned the music, the various performances, there's a lot of themes going on, particularly the performance of Royalty Hightower, who I think sells the whole thing very convincingly.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And another thing that you see in this film is the sheer joy of physical activity. The characters are almost constantly physically active. There's a lot of dance in the film, and that's again quite unique and interesting.
Ashley, I hear you do a bit of dancing from time to time.
I used to. I'm too old now, Mark.
Oh, you're joining the likes of the old fogies in the corner here. So how did you find the movement represented through the film, particularly the challenge, the sort of clash between the boxing that she's starting to do initially and then the dancing that she gets into?
I loved how the dancing was held up against the boxing, because it's showing you this is a real sport. These girls are athletes. They're working as hard as boxers, and they're as strong and as powerful. And it's very explicitly made, that point. And it also very cleverly shows it's not all wearing sequins, running down the hallway, giggling, which we do have here as well. And it's an important element. But it's the physical activity. It's the training. It's the hours of practice. You are a professional athlete.
It's also a film which has a lot to say without saying it too explicitly about those pressures that happen to young children when peer groups sort of settle in. And when we see Tony to start with, she's very much the unconventional boxer, young female boxer, and she gets drawn more towards convention. But it's testing the boundaries of that as well.
Absolutely. To touch on what Ashley said, it's beautiful the way when we first meet Tony, she is the boxer, and when she's drawn to these stance troupe, we're not sure they call them that in America, but she's trying.
It's
to,
a drill team.
It's
sorry,
a drill
I remembered,
team.
Just remembered.
People. It's not a dance troupe. It's
breaking
a drill
news.
Team. And she's trying to do the dance, and she's not graceful like the others, but she's so powerful. And over time, it's lovely how you just see her take the power from her boxing, and she turns it into this graceful dance while still keeping the power. And there's so many themes running through this film, particularly coming of age and females and how they have to fit in with others. She feels she doesn't really belong in either world at first. She's the hard boxer, and then as she becomes in part of the drill team, you suddenly see her wearing nail varnish and she pierces her own ears to fit in. And I could just go on forever about the female's growing up aspect of fitting in, which we can, most of us in here, well, I say most, half of us can relate to from
three
being
quarters
at school.
Of the reviewers. I really like the comments on what it means to be a girl, and it's just so disappointing to realise and see it on screen that little girls think if they have pink glittery nails and earrings, oh, I fit in with all the girls now. And I love her braids tailing down her back, because she looks so much like one of the guys. She's wearing the same thing. She's muscular. The other girls call her guns. But the only thing that separates her from all the guy boxers are her gorgeous braids all the way down to her bum, nearly.
I mean, we've talked very much about the feminine aspects of this film from a female director with a largely female cast. So the obvious question for me to come to you with, Alistair, is the African-American side of things, as clearly not African-American as you are. Because this is a film, we've talked so extensively about the gender politics that you can almost overlook the fact that these are African-American characters, and nothing is really ever made of that, because In the same way as Moonlight, it's just a matter of fact. It's not trying to make these people special or, you know, downgrade or upgrade or anything else because of their background. They are just who they are, and it's a universal theme.
Yeah, and I found it completely refreshing that we have a film with an entire African-American cast, although I think that the coach that we never see in focus, the only adult that we see in the film, I think that she may be white, but you never fully see her in focus because this is fully about the children. And it's so refreshing to see a film that doesn't make an issue of race despite the fact that the entire cast are African-American. And it's puzzling why this is such a novelty. Why are there no more films like this that treat race with a complete disregard?
And maybe films like this and Moonlight will be the start of opening that floodgates. I think we also need to talk a bit about the style of the film. It's shot in a very dramatic widescreen and often used made of that frame. But also, for about the first 20 minutes, almost no dialogue. It says a lot without, in some cases, saying anything at all.
Yes, yeah, so it feels experimental, but without being the sort of dull that's sometimes attached to that. Yeah, and the music as well, this spooky atmospheric music that sort of has almost a horror feel in, but never quite takes you to a horror place in the film.
It's a very well-structured film from somebody who's making their debut as a director. And for me, it really sort of took me aback the last maybe 5-10 minutes as well, because it doesn't necessarily end in the ways that you'd expect.
Again, like certain women, we can't say it's one genre or the other, and even at the end of the film, you have no idea what you're watching. There's, when all the lights turn off in the gym, you think this is going full horror now. But then there's the witchcrafty elements as well, and the fantasy where she goes outside of her own mind, and we see what's happening to her in her head on the bridge with the drill team. It's a really gorgeous ending. You love the ending, and there's the odd harrowing creepiness about it still as well.
I don't know if anyone else has seen the Carol Morley film The Falling, which was a similar feeling of young girls going through sort of fits. It in this case used as that metaphor to understand that experience. But talking to you before the show, actually, you also mentioned there's maybe some other connections in there as well.
Much like you don't know what genre you're watching, and we've mentioned already that this is a film about the kids and you see it through their eyes, so they don't know what's going on either. They get snippets of adult conversation or they hear a bit of news on the radio. No one explains to them, because children don't deserve to be talked to and have things explained to them. They don't need that. They have no idea what's happening to each other and to themselves. It's something in the water, quite literally, maybe, or then it might be like Laura was saying, we might go a bit crucible down there. Are the girls making things up? Is it another way they can try and be like each other and be part of the same team? There could be some suggestion of drug use in the community that's never touched on again, because the kids don't get things explained to them. They're just sort of fumbling along and trying to piece together the story.
Alistair, I think we were talking off air and you believe that there's some issues about conformity that the Fitz brings in.
Well, yeah, and in comparison to The Falling, which you mentioned earlier, which has the similar narrative of the fainting spells among girls, and whereas that, I felt, was a more obvious allegory for adolescence and coming into adolescence, The Fitz seems to be not so much about that. It seems to be more about conformity, because every time a member of the dance troupe has one of these fainting spells, they seem to emerge back from it with the ability to perform the same choreography that they were struggling with before. They are able to fit in with the group of older girls and dance seamlessly.
To the point where I think there's a sort of turning point in the film where actually, rather than being fearful of the Fitz, one of the characters actually is trying to embrace that so that she can then become part of the group.
She is, absolutely. And to touch on it, it takes you back to a time such as at school where girls are starting to talk about their first kiss or their first sexual experience. And it really relates to that. It's the older girls that have the Fitz at first, and it's the younger girls looking on. And they do start to want these Fitz. They're hoping for it. They're trying to make it happen even sometimes, staring out windows, trying to go into trances. And it really relates to when you're growing up, that once you've started to do these things or have the Fitz in this case, you become more accepted, you're more part of the group and you fit in with the older girls.
It's sort of commenting on conditioning as well. Do we learn our feminine behaviours, or are they instilled in us? And I think Royalty Hightower's character suggests that she's turning herself into a girl because she's learnt her behaviours from her brother and all his boxing friends who she spends all her time with. And there's they suggest there's a lack of any sort of, well, we never see anyone's parents. We never see their lives outside of the gym. And her brother definitely seems to be taking on the parental role. He mentions, oh, tell mum I'll make dinner again. So she really has no female role models from what I can see. So she learns her masculine behaviours and then finds the dance troupe, sees these girls, this is my tribe, this is who I want to be like, this is who I want to hang out with, then gets the ears pierced, the nail varnish comes out. And so she's conditioning herself to be a woman, just like all the girls are trying to condition themselves to have one of these fits and become an amazing dancer.
I thought it was a lovely story as well of friendship amongst not even teenagers, sort of pre-teens. The three girls, Tony, Bianca, Maya, the time they spend together, the things that they do together. And I thought it was a really interesting study of that.
Because quite often, if we're talking about a film with teenage girls in, you think about the Mean Girls archetype, where actually there'd be someone who would be almost a sort of bullying or controversial figure in the group. But actually, these are a group of girls who by and large, get on with each other throughout the film.
It's really positive about kids in general, and especially, as you're saying, girls, because, like you say, we don't see them at school sort of being bitchy and bullying. We just see them in this gym where they're all working for hours and hours every day to become professional athletes. The older girls run the dance team. There's only that one out-of-focus shot we see of the adult coach. She rocks up once for 30 seconds, and it's what these kids are achieving with their lives, and obviously depleted socioeconomic surroundings, we can see that. But it's a really positive comment on what kids are capable of.
And is it remarkable that in just an hour and 10-minute film, as we keep harping on, or I keep harping on about, that we don't actually see their lives outside the gym? All of that detail comes from brief snatches of conversation or all their behaviours.
Yeah, there's one little quick mention of my foster carer, and yeah, it doesn't overblow the economic surroundings, just like it doesn't overblow the race issue in this at all. And we're really focusing on the female friendships and what the kids are achieving on their own, regardless of what colour they happen to be or how much money their parents don't have.
And I suspect that, again, that's because of the way it was made. I think they used a real dance troupe called to make the film, so they were able to sort of put their main focus was the dancing, rather than maybe professional actors' main focus would have been all the other things.
I mean, for me, it struck me that even the little details in terms of attention, some of the choreography, when Tony first starts her dancing moves, she's still got very much the boxing style with the jabs.
She gives a right hook when you're supposed to be.
And it gradually evolves into the more the similar style to the rest of the dancers. Mm. And that's again done very subtly. It's all these little touches. It's also, I think, a film which it would be impossible to undersell how well it captures the mindset of teenagers. I mean, it is a long time since I was one, I have to say, but it does feel to me, you know, I could hark back to those kind of times, even as a boy, when a lot of the film was about girls, and understand those kind of challenges and relationships.
Yeah, it's tiny little things that I'm not sure many filmmakers would think to leave in, like when you're waiting to be picked up. There's really long scenes of them waiting to be picked up and they're climbing all over the barriers and stuff. And that's it's something that I don't think directors leave in because they don't think that's an important part of being an actual human being, which a lot of directors and writers don't think kids are. They don't think that's an important part of their lives. And it is, spending those torturous hours just waiting for adults.
And in terms of the detail of the film as well, it's also even at the level that the fits themselves were choreographed. Each one is different for each of the girls involved. Every single little detail of the film is cultured and cultivated in such an important way.
And the director made sure that none of the other actors saw the fits until it was performed for the first time, and that makes the final amazing fit that our heroine sort of goes through. I loved seeing the reaction on the little girls' faces, because I didn't know that before I saw the film. It made so much sense, because without too much of a spoiler, there would have been some sort of physical element to be able to get her to do what she's doing. You don't see all of her body, but to enable her to be where she is, something else must be going on that only the other actors can see, and the wonder and astonishment on their faces as she sort of creeps round the corner. I loved that. That was my favourite part.
I also liked how the girls were apparently allowed to change their script, and they were allowed to add bits in and do what they wanted with their dance moves. And that really made it feel more realistic. I didn't feel like I was watching a girl acting at any point. I felt that was her. and them being able to express their own parts, especially her best friend, who's like the sassy little one who'd say whatever she wanted. You could really tell that was
her personality.
That was her, and it really added to it. Yeah.
Royalty Hightower has never, ever, ever acted before. This is her first ever acting job.
And
to be able, to be able to hold a scene just with your face and no dialogue is something that seasoned actors with decades of experience struggle with sometimes.
And you know, we sort of talked about the gender issues very much at the fore, the issues of race and colour, which are almost non-existent. The issues of this being an almost child-centred film, weird feeling like Tom and Jerry with the complete absence of the dominant figure there. Is this something that again people of any age will relate to?
Yeah, I think so. And I think also the fact that apparently she workshopped the film a lot with the actors, that's another thing that makes it really fresh. But I don't think you necessarily have to be young or old to like it. I think anyone would like it.
Another startling recommendation then, a good set on this show. We just can't seem to find anything to criticise, which is good. The Fitz opened last week, and after a short run at the Arts Picture House, you can catch it this Monday, 8 p.m. at Saffron Screen, Saffron Walden's Community Cinema, and I think we'd all say it's well worth the trip. It's a certificate 12A. Written, directed and designed by Annabella to such an extent that she receives 10 on-screen credits, new release The Love Witch is a heady mix of classic Hollywood colour, the scandalous female-led films of pre-Hays Code-era 1930s cinema, and flamboyant French-flavoured fantasy. Set in a heavily stylised present day, The Love Witch stars Samantha Robinson as Elaine, a white witch living in the Technicolor sun of California coast. After her husband's sudden and unexpected death, she decides she needs to find herself another man. But her love spells prove too potent, and one by one, her suitors wind up mysteriously and horrifically dead.
Witchcraft is just a way of concentrating energy. It can only work with what's already there. I just use sex magic to create love magic. Sometimes it's almost scary how strong the love gets.
And sex magic, of course.
Burn the witch! Burn the witch! Burn the witch! Burn the witch!
I would do anything for love.
Ashley, The Love Witch has an abundance of style thanks to Annabella's dedication, but is it style over substance or something more?
On first reading, it was definitely style over substance. I got to the end and thought, I hated that film. I hated everything about it. I hated the characters. I hated the way they treated women. I hated the ridiculous subject matter. But then I realised I was supposed to. that they're aping the way women were treated on screen in the 60s. And it's just pathetic. The actress as well isn't very accomplished. She hasn't done a lot of work, but she doesn't need to. She's hammy here. She just needs her breasts on show and to look good in brightly coloured, form-fitting clothing. And that's all she gives, really.
I think this may be a difference in our readings. My reading was that actually the acting is all of a very similar style, because that's the way that Annabella has asked these people to act.
Yeah.
That she has encouraged that hammy style within them.
Mm.
Because she is styled this film to such an extent that she's taken control over the performances, over everything else. Does that risk that some of the points she's trying to make about some of these early films, the way that women were treated, get a bit lost in that? Particularly because it runs to 2 hours, and she had apparently another hour of material. She would have put out a 3-hour cut had she felt anyone would have watched it.
Yeah, it's like I said, it was only after the fact that I got the feminism comments. But I'm sure she's well aware of that. She knows that certain people, maybe males of a certain age, won't read into that. But it's quite starkly obvious to me as a younger female watching this. What is going on with the women in this film? What what is going on? Because happily, I don't see so much of that in films that I've been watching since I started watching them in the early 90s. So, apart from Showgirls, Verhoeven.
Yes. There's a few comparisons that have been made to things like Russ Meyer films, like Valley of the Dolls and things like that, which I think is a comparison that Annabella doesn't find particularly favourable. Does her film do enough to stand away from those comparisons?
That's not a bad comparison for me, because I like kitschy, and this is kitschy, and it's going to stand the test of time because of it. Because it's so heavily styled, it's already out of date. I think it will come back for cult classic. I think it's gonna get there eventually.
There is a phenomenal look to the film. She made the decision to shoot on 35mm film to get that style. She called in experts in particular fields to make sure that everything was aping that style of the sort of 50s, 60s Hollywood films. She even spent time producing a lot of the props herself. She built the sets herself. She composed the music herself.
Wow.
So it took her 7 years to make this film because she was doing things herself to save money that other directors would have just got someone in
if
to do.
If you want a job doing right, do it yourself. And she did.
a powerful feminist message there, I think, as much as anything else. But actually, is that a step too far? Is someone investing their life in a film like this for 7 years?
It's the way all films should be made. Anything that you want to take people's money for and have them visit a cinema to watch should be... everything you have should have been given to it. And it's... a leaf could be taken out of her book. Don't just chuck out another flipping Marvel reboot. Like, think about what you're doing. Take some time. Make everything as beautiful and perfect and fitting to the world you've created as you can.
Is it, in some ways, a difficult film to categorise? Because it was it premiered in this country at Fright Fest in London, and they're helping to push the DVD release, which is it's now available on DVD and Blu-ray. I can only imagine the Blu-ray looks magnificent. But... yeah, it sort of feels like it should be categorised as a horror film, but there's not particularly many overt horror elements in it.
No, it's where does it really scary. Sit? It's supernatural, isn't it? But then it's not, because there's.
And there's almost a fetishistic detail to a lot of her detail with the witchcraft. You know, I mean, I feel like the scene in the shop where she's going in and setting her stuff up could have lasted about 3 hours if Annabella had been, again, allowed to run with it that far.
Yeah, it's going to have to be chucked into that awfully vast genre that is art house. It's art house, so if you like art house, go and see this. But it's a lot of fun as well. It's funny and pacey and looks great.
As mentioned, The Love Witch has screenings at the Arts Picture House on Monday and Wednesday of this week, and it's also out now on DVD, Blu-ray and streaming services. It's a certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Despite winning Best Film and Best Actress at last year's César Awards, the new release, Elle, is one of the most contentious and controversial films. Probably no surprise, given that it marks a return to feature filmmaking after a decade from one of cinema's most provocative directors, Paul Verhoeven. Isabelle Huppert stars as Michelle LeBlanc, a businesswoman who is raped in her own home by a masked assailant. Despite the urging of friends, she refuses to report the assault. Rather, she seems to go about her life as if nothing had happened. Unbeknown to them, she's already out shopping for pepper spray and a rather sharp axe.
J'ai pris sur le vif. Il était accroupi dans les buissons en train d'observer votre maison.
Et vous avez vu son visage?
Non, il portait un masque ou une espèce de cagoule de ski.
Tu la raccompagnes?
Ouais.
Non, c'est pas la peine. C'est joli ton truc là. Tu vas au ski?
Quand tu veux, je t'emmène.
On devrait être encore ensemble. C'est de ta faute.
Tu m'as quitté, Michel.
Tu m'as frappé. C'est pas la première fois qu'il se manifeste. Tu pirates les ordinateurs perso de tous les employés.
C'est grave comme infraction.
Mais il y a un fou qui rôde. Non, mais les fous, j'ai l'habitude. C'est ma spécialité. Tu t'es bien foutu de ce que je pouvais penser, hein. J'étais dans un déni étrange, mais maintenant j'y vois clair.
Plus dangereuse, Michel, c'est tout de même toi.
Ashley, Elle isn't the first time that Paul Verhoeven's provoked with sexual politics in films such as Basic Instinct and Showgirls. Will Elle stand the test of time more than those films?
Don't lump this in with any of his other work. I hate this guy, and I had no idea he directed it. Apparently he's highly regarded, but he made Showgirls and Basic Instinct. This is a completely different film to that. He's making... happily, those have been relegated to kitsch, ridiculous, anti-feminist pieces that they are, this is making really important and complex points on a number of issues. And the rape scene at the beginning has completely dominated conversation, but he's talking about so much more here, about victimization and fluid sexuality, again obviously feminist issues. That's the rape at the beginning is just a very small part of her story. There are several other characters with very complex lives, and they all interweave beautifully, and this is fantastic filmmaking. And I'm really annoyed that what happens to her has completely overshadowed any kind of other conversation or sort of reading into it, really.
It's a film that takes a few twists and turns, and they're all very much centred around Isabel Huppert's performance, which did get some recognition in award season, unusually for a foreign language film. Do we think anyone other than Isabel Huppert could have actually played this role? Alistair.
Oh, it's going
yes.
to me.
Yeah, my list of people who've seen this film seems to be not quite correct, so after a slight fumble.
Yes, no, I think Isabel Huppert is perfectly casting, and it also acts as a companion piece to another film she acted in, Michael Haneke's The Piano Teacher, in which that film she played a similar character with a sort of... I'm trying to speak very vaguely due to the content of both films, but the characters had similar fetishes, so to speak, but they're treated in completely different ways, and both incredibly probing and incisive. But the strange thing about the Verhoeven film is it's not a difficult watch, despite its subject matter. And the more that we experience her family around her, and we get to study like her mother and her mother's relationship with her husband-to-be and her deceased father, who was France's most notorious serial killer, the more we find out about these things, it becomes almost more interesting than the central storyline, and it becomes incredibly entertaining in a darkly comic way.
I mean, it has been described very much as a black comedy, and I think that's a theme that runs through a lot of Paul Verhoeven's films, you know, even things like Starship Troopers, where he's willing to put the heroes in almost Nazi-esque uniforms because he's forever testing those boundaries. And, you know, I quite like the Michael Haneke comparison as well. I love them both as being these sort of provocative figures of cinema, and I think maybe that's got lost in some films like Basic Instinct and Showgirls, neither of which I would say are good films, but I think he's always trying to provoke people with them. I think what's interesting for me here is that it never really feels like Michelle is a victim here at all. She's always on the front foot. She always seems to be one step ahead of the people around her, even her friends.
Yeah.
And you wonder quite how much she's controlling the situation at certain points.
Yeah, and sadly because of that, and I think that's probably true of a lot of sexual assault victims, that if you're seen as a strong woman, then, you're fine, you can get over it. But what else is she supposed to do? She has to quite literally stand up, clear up, and go back to work the next day. What do we want her to be in a corner for a week, rocking back and forth? This is the reality of when terrible things happen to you. Your life continues, your family's lives continues, you still have issues with parents and your sons, and you have to keep going. And I think that the film made that very, very clear, and a very sort of handled it in a good way.
And it's potentially some very tricky subject matter. It doesn't shy away from the depictions of those scenes, but then you also get the converse of that, where at one point it depicts the scene replayed from Isabel Huppert's point of view as you know, what she would have liked to have done and stop her attacker in one of the ways, which gets it an 18 rating. So I won't describe it too much in detail on air at lunchtime. And the best moment for that scene of me was just after it, because it cuts back to Isabel Huppert's face and she just has this tiny little Mona Lisa-esque wry smile afterwards. Paul Verhoeven, known for his grandstanding, there's a lot of subtlety going on in this film, is it fair to say?
Well, especially compared to his previous works, this is probably the most subtle thing he's ever made. But, I mean, coming from the man who's made Showgirls, Starship Troopers and Basic Instinct and Robocop, that is not really saying much. This is obviously subtle in comparison, but the more it gets to the end and the more it sort of tries to resolve the central storyline, it does become more overblown. And the score increasingly sounds like the score that you would imagine in Basic Instinct. It becomes a sort of 90s erotic thriller score the more it comes to the end, which is a really strange decision.
And without saying too much to spoil it, I think the ending has confused a few people, the way in which things play out, because the film does take a bit of a turn about the midway point, and it's not then the film that you maybe thought it was when it first started.
Yeah, there's a wonderful reveal that it turns everything on its head, but that's again a comment on people are complex, because the central character is a sexual person. She has a fluid sexuality and she is entitled to that. That doesn't mean that she invites sexual attention that she does not want. So she's really, really beautifully held up as this complex person with her own life, with her own needs and desires and fetishes in a certain way. And it's still not okay to invite sexual attention that you don't want. I can't talk about it without ruining it. She's badass.
Let's say, as this is only within the show for 1 minute, if you haven't seen the film, turn away now and we can then have a very brief discussion.
Stop listening. Yes. It's one of the best things for me is I haven't been in the cinema for a long, long time where the entire audience has audible gasps several times in this film. That's down to the horror direction. It's really, really brilliant. Every time her attacker shows up, it's wonderfully directed.
In terms of Paul Verhoeven's previous films, we've talked about some of the gender and the politics issues. Almost from the beginning of this film, it's right up front. Isabel Lopez's character has founded her own gaming company, and we see some early scenes of her in development of those games. The almost overly stereotypical, yet again Paul Verhoeven pushing the point of these graphic sex scenes and other things in the game that they're trying to develop, and then the discussions in the office between her and her male counterparts.
Yeah.
It's pushing that environment right from the beginning.
Yeah, it is completely graphic. There's tentacles entering the female characters, and it's a comment on the gaming industry and the film and TV industry as a whole, which feeds into the way we feel it's okay to treat women. But also he makes it difficult to like Michelle all the way through, and a lot like victims of sexual assault are often seen to be complicit in what happened to them. It's what you were wearing, it's how drunk you were. We wonder, you own the company that's making this vile game and putting these images out there. You're complicit in this. And it's sort of, it makes you question what kind of victim she is. And that happens in real life. And even right at the end, when we finally see a police officer, he's questioning her. She's still being questioned. Did you know this guy? Does it matter? So it was a very violent rape. He forced his way into her house. It had nothing to do with her. There was no part of it that was her fault. But he's really brilliantly making you question how much of a victim she is. But it's, and again, when he brings up that she has a fluid sexuality, she has some sort of maybe less than vanilla ideas about what she likes, and that's it still doesn't diminish the fact that she's a victim in what happened to her at the beginning.
It feels like we're coming back to the Michael Haneke comparison again. It was reminding me of films like both of the Funny Games versions, because you can't distinguish between them other than the language. But in the sense of Michael Haneke in a lot of his films confronting the audience and saying, do you actually feel comfortable watching this? We're selling you this particular product. This almost feels of that ilk as well.
Well, Paul Verhoeven is a completely different director to Michael Haneke. And even though morally the complexity of the story that we're being given is difficult for us to sort of process, the film isn't a difficult watch. And that is probably the biggest contradiction of the entire thing. It's the most harrowing subject matter imaginable. And yet it's handled with a lightness of touch that, again, contradictory, just conceals the fact that it has this complex exploration of a very serious issue embedded into it.
And I think the fact that it's not that difficult to watch in places where it should be reminded me, as a woman watching it, how much behaviour I put up with that is not okay. Because it's so pinned and centred around the fact she was raped at the beginning, and you see what she goes through that lens throughout. So things that happen to her in the workplace that you'd never dream of doing to a middle-aged guy. It just wouldn't happen. And I recognise a lot of what I put up with every day. And again, I'm complicit in that. I allow myself to be treated that way because it's easier, and I don't want to fight back, and I don't want to challenge these people that are talking to me in a certain way or regard me in a certain way. But I'm the victim of that. I'm not complicit in it. It's just the way it is. And it's awful to say that is just the way it is at the moment.
It feels very much as if Isabel Lopez's character is striking back against some of these attitudes at certain points. Again, slight spoiler, listen away if you don't want to be spoiled. There's a point in which he suspects one character of being the person who attacked her, and so to prove it, just asks him to drop his trousers. I was thinking back to an anecdote I heard about Starship Troopers, where Paul Verhoeven was directing the shower scene where the soldiers there, and they're supposed to be having a shower, not a sexual scene, they're just supposed to be doing it, but it's a mixed unit of men and women. And when some of the actors felt uncomfortable, Paul Verhoeven said, "Fine, I'll take my clothes off as well," and directed the scene naked. That may be
classic Verhoeven,
but it does feel that some of those attitudes about actually setting some of these preconceptions aside are still things he's exploring 20 years later.
And that was the scene you just mentioned. It makes a really important point of the fact that we also forget that men are victims of sexual assault. They report it so infrequently that it's easily forgotten. But she's sexually assaulting that male colleague of hers in that scene. It's not okay behaviour, but it's less shocking to us because she's a tiny little woman, so she can't possibly hurt him.
And it's a film where pretty much everyone has some kind of moral shades of grey. There's no standout moral characters, with the possible exception of the lady who lives across the road, who is almost a parody of that.
She
because
is,
she's
I was
so
about to say.
Definitively Christian. They're having a dinner party, she breaks away to watch Mass. She's almost set up as this parody figure over in the corner.
And again, that's why I think it works as well as it does a character study as it does an engrossing thriller, because these are characters not drawn in the typical way that you'd imagine in a film. Nobody is inherently good or bad. They are drawn in incredibly complex ways, which is perfect to suit this subject matter.
Well, I have to say, I think, just in conclusion, that I get drawn to these kind of films because I have quite a dark sense of humour and I quite like these confrontational subjects. Is this a film that everyone can find something in, or is it going to be too much for some people?
It doesn't talk down to you at all, so you're going to have to work hard to figure out what's going on here, but I like that. You should be working hard to look through the nuances and the very, very subtle, like you said, her little Mona Lisa smile and, oh, is this person good? Is this person trying to sort of screw the other person over, or are they the victim in this? And it's really difficult, and it's supposed to be, because navigating through what's right and wrong is difficult.
And as we've all mentioned, the fact that this is a very easy film to watch in spite of its subject matter, so it is easy to recommend, but you might get offended by the flippant nature it has towards its subject matter. But I think that is just hiding the fact that it is more complex on the inside.
I think maybe it's done Paul Verhoeven good to take a sort of 10-year break from cinema. He's come back to this completely
grown up,
differently.
Obviously.
Yeah, I mean, he's still making sort of probing social satires, but before, in films like Showgirls and Starship Troopers, all he would use are sort of character archetypes. And this is, for my money, the first time I've seen him develop proper characters. And the best moments are the moments where it feels like a character study happening around the central narrative.
It's been a fantastic week for character, I think. So four fantastic films which we recommend you to catch as soon as you can. We're not going to have much more time to talk about them now, but we will hopefully have a bit more chat in the podcast, as well as a review of The Love Witch, which is showing this week. However, I should just mention that Elle opened yesterday and is now showing at the Arts Picture House, and it's a Certificate 18. So that is all we have time for on the show today. As always, the past hour will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m, while a podcast with extra content will be released on Tuesday via both iTunes and our page on www.cambridge105.fm. For more details on that, or for anything to do with the show, including just to come and chat with us and keep the discussion going, then why not follow us on Facebook or Twitter? A simple search for Bums on Seats will track us down. We'll be back in a fortnight's time on March 25th with a stacked programme of reviews. There'll be the new Beauty and the Beast as Disney continue their marketing strategy of remaking all their animated classics as live action. The Oscar-winning Iranian drama, which I would heartily recommend, from Asghar Vahadi, The Salesman, opens, as does, almost a full year since it premiered at Cannes, Olivia Assayas's Personal Shopper. Plus there's the extraordinary racially tinged horror of Get Out. Please stay tuned for Bookmark, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats,
see ya.
Goodbye.
See you later.
Bye.